Your argument next in LaGloria against the United States, which is number 075010. Now, in this case, I think you can take it as a given that everything said in the Conoco case about the merits of the 16203 issue, the PMM issue, will be deemed to have been made for purposes of this case. So if you want to say anything more on that issue, you're welcome to, but you're also welcome to go directly to the issues that are unique to LaGloria.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I will do that with the court's permission and proceed to the minority price preference claim. LaGloria alleges, again for purposes of a motion to dismiss here, that the price in its contracts was reduced by as much as 10% because the government violated the equal protection component of the Fifth Amendment in the way that it avoided the contracts. LaGloria is seeking a remedy for an illegal contract price. It alleges that the violation of law in the solicitation and award of the contract gave rise to an illegal price in an existing contract. It is therefore seeking a remedy under its contract to correct that illegal price.
And Judge Hewitt here dismissed the lack of subject matter jurisdiction. And the cases you rely on appeal principally are LaBarge and Gould, correct?
Correct.
It seemed a little odd to me. I just wondered if you had raised, I mean, she otherwise wrote a very thorough opinion, and I don't think there's any reference to either those cases or that line of reasoning in our case law. Was that presented to her?
Well, certainly Gould and LaBarge were presented to her.
Because she didn't deal with that issue. The issue that principally you raise on appeal seems to not be one that she actually dealt with.
I can represent to you as an officer of the court that those cases were discussed in detail in the briefs below. I am at something of a loss to understand why they weren't. They were addressed, as you see, in the Tesoro decision where these issues were in the court.
No, but you agree with me that they weren't addressed in her opinion.
I have to go back, but not in any meaningful, not in any extensive detail. I think the court's ruling there, in effect, that the violation of law in the award or solicitation of contract cannot give rise to a claim under the Tucker Act, I think just would rewrite existing law. I think there is simply too much authority in this court. It says that where there is a causal relationship, that's articulated in Gould and then later adopted by the court in Cessna, that you do have a claim under the Tucker Act. And whatever claim you may have had in terms of a bid protest, once the contract is awarded, if you allege that that price was diminished by unlawful acts, you have a separate and independent action to recover a lawful price. Or stated differently, the government is not permitted to retain the benefit of an illegal price simply because it was not caught or precluded in the solicitation process. Once again, the issue is that the law controls.
Now, just as a kind of technical matter, I'm getting confused between these cases. We established in the prior case of Conoco, and I don't want to go back there, but we established that you had not raised on appeal, at least, the issue of the small business auction piece of it. It was just the equal protection minority set aside. What's at stake in this case then, so I can be clear? Is it just the equal, did she just dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction the equal protection set aside issue, or are we also raising the small business auction?
We are raising the illegal auction claim here. She dismissed for lack of jurisdiction both the minority price preference and illegal auction claim. She did not reach the merits of either claim. The government, as you know, has argued the merits of the illegal auction claim here, although it was not reached by the court below. I think there has been perhaps some confusion because the Fifth Amendment is implicated here, some confusion below, and the bring a cause of action for violation of the Fifth Amendment itself. It is not a money mandating constitutional provision for purposes of the Tucker Act. And we have no quarrel, obviously, with that well-established holding. But the distinction here is that we are not bringing a claim under the Fifth Amendment. We're bringing a claim based on the contract. I think in Google, the court made that very clear, said they're not bringing a claim under the statute that requires a stable design. They're bringing a claim under their contract. Similarly, excessive.
And the piece of the contract here is, because she did say you've clarified that. I mean, she goes through in her opinion. The piece of the contract here is the price?
Correct, Your Honor. The price was illegal. It was unlawfully diminished because of the government's violation of the law. And thus, again, I would point similarly to Cessna, which was a case involving allegations of violation of the Anti-Deficiency Act. The court, again, there was clear not only to find jurisdiction, but to say this is not a claim under the Anti-Deficiency Act, but rather a claim under the contract for an unlawful price. Indeed, there's no way in a case like Cessna, where you have the Anti-Deficiency Act, which precludes the payment of money, that you could find that as a money-mandating statute. But the court said, well, that's not really relevant here, because it's not a claim under the Anti-Deficiency Act. It's a claim under the contract in the Tucker Act case, separate jurisdiction there.
But what's a little confusing is in the complaint itself, and I think the judge required some clarification at some point, because in the complaint itself, your Fifth Amendment claim alleges that DESC knowingly administered or awarded and administered plaintiff's contracts in violation of the Equal Protection Clause. So there you're talking about the administration and awarding of that. Now, and I think before Judge Hewitt, at least as she explained it, you were talking about the unconstitutionality of the price clause in the contract, which the two notions seem a little different, right?
Well, I would point to some other language in the complaint that I think was not perhaps fully comprehended by the lower court, but we state, for example, at appendix page 62, as a result of DESC's language admitted here, 10% price preference for minority-owned suppliers, DESC paid plaintiff ConocoPhillips prices for military fuel that were below fair market value. I mean, there's an express causal link alleged in the complaint between...
Yeah, but that seems to be under, in fairness, that seems to be under the whole discussion of the PMM.
Right. I think, Your Honor, you'll find it's under a separate heading for...
Distortion of the market value of military fuel.
Let me look at page 62 here, Your Honor, if I may.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. It says in other ways besides that. You're right. You're right. I'm looking at paragraph 26 in addition.
I do think that a fair reading of the complaint is that we allege that this violation of the equal protection component of the Fifth Amendment caused the diminution in the contract price. I think that under well-established authority here that there is jurisdiction for that claim. Moving on, unless there are other questions on the minority price preference claim, to the illegal auction claim. Again, I think the jurisdictional issue, which is the issue upon which the court ruled, is essentially identical to that of the minority price preference claim, in the sense that we allege an illegality in the award or solicitation of the contract that unlawfully diminished the contract price. And as the court has alluded to, I would point to LaBarge, which involves violation of some of the very same regulations, 16.510 on the prohibitions of auctions, that we allege were violated here. And the court expressly found that there was jurisdiction there, albeit under the Contract Disputes Act. But I think the reasoning of the court there is equally applicable under the Tucker Act, and I think has largely been followed by this court. So I think that those two issues jurisdictionally are the same, and that, again, the authorities of this court make clear that an allegation of illegality in the award or solicitation of a contract that gives rise to an illegal price is within the jurisdiction of the Tucker Act. The government has asked the court to proceed with the illegal auction claim on the merits, although the court of federal claims below reached the merits. I'm pleased to address those issues with the court now. The Office of Federal Procurement Policy Act precludes the disclosure of bidder proposal information or source selection information during a procurement that relates to award of the underlying contract. I don't think that there is any real question that the government does what the Act says they should not do. They take the bid price or adjusted bid price of large businesses and offer it to small businesses and say, if you'll match it, we'll give you the contract award. I don't think the real issue here is whether the Office of Federal Procurement Policy Act says that you can't do that. I think that it clearly says that you cannot do that. The question is, does this practice fall within the authorized exception of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy Act? And in our view, it does not and cannot, because the way the government conducts this auction is expressly prohibited by the FAR. Once again, the FAR says that when you're going to do these parallel procurements, you have to award the contracts first to the large businesses, and when you're done, go and award to the small businesses. In that sense, the procurement is over for the large businesses, so you don't have this issue of disclosing their price while the procurement is ongoing. Also, the FAR says that you cannot go back and forth between the large and small businesses. You can't shuttle back and forth, because that allows you, really, the government, the leverage of the very evil that happens here is that you are, in essence, telling the large business, if you don't bid low enough so that the small business here will decline the contract, you're out of the picture. Again, I don't think there's any dispute but that what the government does is inconsistent with the FAR. The government admits it. The General Accounting Office has found it. I would point out that the Accountability Office, and old habits die hard, I'm sorry, that case, that decision, does predate the Office of Federal Procurement Policy Act. So while it talks about the FAR provisions and it says that DESC is violating the FAR provisions, it of course has no bearing on compliance with the Office of Federal Procurement Policy Act, which was not applicable to that contract, which is a 1987 contract, and the one PPA is awarded in 1988. Again, I think the whole issue of is the government authorized to do this is really resolved by the deviations. The government alleges that it has deviations which permit it to depart from the FAR. Well, if they're alleging that they have to have permission to depart from the FAR, then they are conceding that they do in fact depart from the FAR. And we would take on the deviations in the first instance by saying, where are they and what do they say? Conspicuously, the government has failed to proffer them or even to allege that they're not available. And so if they're going to come in the first instance and say our conduct meets the authorized exception to OFPPA because we have deviations, well, they've got to show us the deviations and show us that they authorize them to do what they have done here. In addition, I think the reason, frankly, that they have not shown us the deviations is that they are nowhere published in the Federal Register, and we cite authority for the proposition that a class deviation of the type that they're talking about here would happen by federal law and by regulation has to be published in the Federal Register. Finally, with regard to the deviations, we would make the point that at some level you're rewriting the statute, and you can't do that by regulation or by deviation. We would submit that what's going on here is fundamentally cutting across the core of the statute. Congress said, the integrity of federal procurement and everyone being on a level playing field is paramount here, and we're not going to have the government selectively disclosing bid prices from one party to another, giving one party an advantage over the other. It pollutes the entire process. And I would submit that even if there were deviations, that these deviations here cut so fundamentally across the express language of the regulation that they would not be permitted. They would, in effect, be rewriting the law. I think what this authorized exception really had to do with was situations where the government hires an outside expert to help them evaluate the bids. Well, obviously, they're going to have to disclose that information. They're not talking about disclosing it one bidder to the next. They're talking about, you know, as they bring in outside experts to help the government evaluate the bids. There are circumstances where the courts have upheld disclosure, again, of bid prices. LaBarge was one of them. And there they said where the disclosure is required to comply with a fundamental aspect of procurement policy, there that there's equal disclosure to everyone, then a disclosure of a bid price is permitted. But we've got to have this fundamental procurement policy that is thwarted by the failure of disclosure for it to meet the authorized exception here. Here not only do we not have a fundamental policy that requires disclosure, indeed we have a fundamental policy and FAR regulations that preclude disclosure.
Now, Mr. Burt, you run through your time. If you have one concluding comment that you would like to make, we will give you back your couple of minutes of rebuttal time in the event.
If I could save a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
All right, we'll give you a couple of minutes back for rebuttal. Thank you. Mr. Gilliam.
Mr. Burt gave a wonderful speech, but not about this case. What the judge below had to deal with is the fact that there were no facts and evidence to establish the court's jurisdiction. We challenged the court's jurisdiction basically saying that the allegations appeared to be one that really were a facial attack. And I think our construction of the complaint is fair and it's worth reading. First of all, this is based on, and this is what the court was confronted with, which is what LaGloria first actually alleged, then what it actually proved. So, I think it's section 69 is where they began their auction complaint.
What page are you on there?
I'm at page 64 of the LaGloria
yes, right.
Complaint. Appendix. We began our analysis here, and that's where the court began its analysis. Complaint reads, DESC knowingly awarded and administered each of plaintiff's contracts in violation of the OFPPA Act and its implementing regulations by using prohibited auction techniques, whereby plaintiff DESC awarded contracts to bidders that agreed to match other bidders' price. Now, although it said that the contracts were administered incorrectly, as we'll see in a moment, there's really no evidence to that effect. This appeared to be, and we said this in our moving brief, that what this really was a facial attack on the DESC set-aside program itself, and then we got into the merits of the auction question, and we proffered a proposed finding, which I'll show you in a minute, and show you how the lawyer responded. So, we'll actually get to that now. Page 749, we then, understanding that this complaint really was an attack on the award system itself, offer a fairly simple proposed finding of fact, which we then proceeded to argue required the dismissal of this count. It's at page 749 of the LaGloria appendix. We cited specifically to the FAR provision, and we cited specifically to the DESC provision, which was in the solicitations, and we said that where there's a set-aside failure, the quantities are awarded to the low offeror for the basic quantity rather than being resolicited as a new requirement. This procedure avoids the delay that would take place in resoliciting set-aside failures, and we provided evidence. We identified this as being pursuant to a deviation, and we supplied the clause itself, which says deviation in parentheses. Although the deviation does not pertain to the actual match price method itself, which is authorized, and we cited to the Government Accountability Office, formerly the Government Accounting Office study, which reviewed this process and found it to be legal. LaGloria's response only was that it needed additional evidence to respond, and otherwise, allegations concerning the law. And it then provided a 56F affidavit, but made no attempt to explain what it might learn other than to say it required this additional information.
So this is an argument on the merits. So you responded on the merits, on the legality of the
program. Well, we explained that this was not an auction because if you actually track the documents and saw exactly. The allegation basically is, as we understand it from the briefs and so forth, it's found in complaint paragraph 40, and this is at page 64.
But the question
said that it improperly solicited and awarded portions of the procurement set aside for small businesses together with those for large businesses. We said that fails to state.
The question is, why wasn't that an argument that Judge Hewitt was entitled to evaluate? You may be right and that it isn't an auction, but what Judge Hewitt is saying is I can't touch it.
Eventually, she dismissed it on those grounds.
And why is that right? As opposed to the question of whether it's an auction or not, why is it the case that the Court of Federal Claims does not have the authority to address the question of whether there was an auction, an improper auction in this case?
Because when you say this case, you're referring to these contracts.
Sure.
What we said was this is a broadside attack on the program generally. Simply the way that this would work as follows. On a given contract, if, and there's no allegations occurred with respect to any of these particular contracts, certainly there's no evidence adduced based on our challenge, which required Labloria to come forward and show a factual predicate for the court's jurisdiction, that is, that its contracts were affected by the allegations. So even setting aside the merits of the allegations, we were waiting for a declaration saying, now wait a minute, we actually offered to sell fuel to, say, Tinker Air Force Base in 1994, pick your year. And in that year, however, in that particular solicitation, DESC set aside 10% of it. And realizing that there was going to be this 10% set aside, which we believe is illegal and violates our Fifth Amendment rights, we then had to sharpen our pencils and lower our bids.
Well, wait a minute. We're getting Fifth Amendment. I mean, small business versus minority. The Fifth Amendment is not in the small business. It's
right.
That is the regulatory.
It's the same reasoning and Judge Hewitt basically.
It's easy to get the wires crossed there.
Right, okay. All right. Let's talk about the set-asides. The set-asides work like this. The government decides, the DSC decides.
X amount is going to go to small businesses if they can meet the
potential.
Right,
exactly.
Okay.
So the first thing it does is conduct the bids among the non-small businesses, perfectly legitimate. It determines for a particular location what it's going to cost the government to get fuel to that location. Let's say Tinker Air Force Base. So if the going rate, the best price the government can get to Tinker Air Force Base is 50 cents plus 2 cents for delivery, let's say 5 cents for delivery, that's 55 cents lay down price to Tinker Air Force Base. Now it looks at, let's say that particular requirement is determined to be that which the government seeks to set aside. So now it negotiates. It does not say LaGloria has given us 55, has bid 55 cents. It, now taking that total cost, the lay-down cost of the government, 50 cents for Gloria plus 5% for transport the fuel, it then seeks to negotiate with a small business a price of 55 cents laid down at Tinker Air Force Base, Oklahoma. So the small business says, I'm going to sell to you for 55 cents, but I'll cover the transportation. It's matched the price. It doesn't really know what Gloria's price is. The government, however, is now authorized to accept that because knowing that the government's total lay-down price to a large business is 55 cents, knowing that a bidder, small business bidder, has met the 55 cents price, it's negotiated to that 55 cent level, it said, fine, you can have that price. If that was the fact in anyone with respect to any one of these years, then there's no contract that was affected at all because there's a successful set-aside and the glory is not affected. Since we don't have an allegation concerning which particular contracts actually were affected, the court doesn't have a contract before it that's affected by this allegation. Now, it also could have happened that in a particular year, the example that I gave, LaGloria having bid 50 cents, say the government picks up the 5 cents for transportation, and the government has a set-aside failure because nobody can meet this total 55 cent lay-down price. So now the government comes back to LaGloria, and let's just say further that LaGloria actually is the low bidder. It has in fact succeeded in outbidding all the other large competitors, not allegedly. Then the government goes back to LaGloria and says, congratulations, you wanted this, you wanted to sell us gasoline, it's 50 cents, we're going to buy gasoline from you at 50 cents. There's no further negotiation saying, you know, we could have got this for 54 cents from a small business because they were going to pay, the freight. And so why don't you lower your price? They simply award at the offered price. Now, a third possibility is with a set-aside failure, the government goes now back to the non-smalls, and the Gloria has not won. The Gloria does not have a low price, and so it goes somewhere else. All of these are live possibilities with this program. If you want to attack it on its face, go to a district court and attack it on its face, or claim that you want to award a specific contract in the Court of Federal Claims and lodge a bid protest. But if you want to allege, as the Gloria now insists it's doing, that you have a contract that was affected by a non-set-aside failure, first show what that contract was, that there was a set-aside failure, and that you were awarded the contract. And then at least allege that you were harmed by an affidavit, a declaration saying, and in order to somehow game that system, we consciously lowered our price. Now, as we've explained, under the system, there's no reason why you would lower your price because you really have to beat out the bigs, not the smalls. Nonetheless, maybe there's some reason Gloria actually figured it had to do that, and perhaps one of its declarants could have explained it to the Court of Federal Claims, but it didn't. So we had no contract before the Court of Federal Claims actually even alleged to have been affected by the small set-aside failure, even if the government's small set-aside program is completely illegal. That's why the court had no jurisdiction.
And what about the equal protection aspect of it then, the minority set-aside? I mean, she identified the clause in the contract is the price clause. And they claim that in the absence of minority set-asides, that price would have been 10% higher, or whatever the number is. Why isn't that sufficient under LaBarge and Gould to establish subject matter jurisdiction?
Same reason I just gave you for the small set-aside. If there's no allegation that a particular contract, in this case, was affected by the government's program. We've not met the allegations here, for sure. There's an allegation here that this... The government's small disadvantage business, 10% price preference, is discriminatory in violation of the Fifth Amendment. We did not argue one way or the other. We simply said, again, reading the actual allegation here, paragraph 41 on page 64. DESC awarded administered contracts in violation of contracts in violation of the Equal Protection Amendment by extending to minority-owned businesses bidding preferences not narrowly tailored and so forth. We said and offered again a proposed finding of fact that offered simple, uncontroverted facts. The lawyer's response simply was, these are conclusions of law. We agree. We stated that this appeared to us to be a facial attack on the program. The court read it the same way. The lawyer was offered the opportunity, in fact, was required now, as the claimant, to step forward with jurisdictional facts to establish the court's jurisdiction and say, well, no, there is a contract. We're talking about one of our contracts that actually was awarded, and we had to lower our price.
But didn't they say that? Look at paragraphs 27, 28, and 29 on appendix 62 that preceded that. Why isn't that? I mean, those paragraphs allege that this happened in this case, right? Or why am I missing? Why am I missing?
Well, 27 is, of course, the auctions. That's we're not talking about the small business set aside,
right,
not
right.
The
so it's 28 and 29.
Amendment argument. 27, as you can see, is quite broad. We read this and believed, again, that this was part of our reason for seeing this was a facial attack.
Well, in 29 it says, as a result of the auction and its 10% price preference, minority-owned suppliers, DESC paid plaintiff prices for military fuel that were materially far below the market. I mean, they've made that allegation. Why isn't that enough to establish that there was a connection between their attack on this program and what happened to the contract in this case?
Frankly, our response with regard to that was, as we've said with regard to the PMM, that there was no, that just fails to state a cause of action. There really is no right to fair market value or fair and reasonable prices.
Do you mean that if this had said materially below what they would have obtained otherwise, then it would be okay, but the language that was used is jurisdictionally flawed?
That would certainly be closer to the allegation we expect to see, and then expect to see upon our challenge at least a declaration showing that there was actually a contract in this case. And declarations were offered, but none of them went to this at all. It was curious that in fact the Glory was able to offer, although identical conclusory allegations regarding PMM, could not offer any at all with regard to this one. Anyway, that's the way we read this, and apparently the court agreed and read it the same way.
Well, the paragraph does talk about the fact that DESC paid plaintiff prices for military fuel. That certainly was made pursuant to a contract. That implicates the contract, does it not?
It does.
Okay.
And then I'd say that could be dismissed on the grounds that it fails to state a cause of action because there's no requirement under this program or any other rule of law that they are required to be paid quote unquote fair market value.
Okay.
In other words, I'd still say, still arguing 12b1, but an alternative 12b6, that there's no allegation that they've actually reduced their prices as a result of this or failed to supply any evidence to the effect. Did
the government also preserve a waiver argument, kind of the waiver argument that the Judge Weiss decided in Conoco is an alternative in this case?
We briefed the waiver in this case as an alternative basis for dismissing all of these claims.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The other thing, we talked about Gould briefly. We treated Gould in the briefs. The Gould case appeared to us to be more of a garden variety changes case. Gould claims that its contract really was to provide to build radios, it was in that case, based upon a design provided by the government, with every expectation that design, there were Bancroft radios, that there was every expectation that the design supplied by the government was sufficient to go right to production. And in fact, what it required was to do some development as well as production. And so to that extent, it really presents garden variety changes claim well within the court's jurisdiction. LaBarge presents a clear allegation of clerical error within this court's mistaken bid jurisprudence, and to the extent that the mistaken bid resulted in a clearly lower written price than was intended, that stated a cause of action as well because its pricing provision was directly affected. Here we've seen no evidence that anything the government did with respect to these programs affected the actual prices of contracts before the Court of Federal Claims.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gillian. Mr. Burt, a couple of minutes. If you
quickly on the record, if I may,
of course.
I would like to invite the court's attention to paragraph 31 of the complaint.
Which paragraph?
Paragraph 31.
31.
Where we identify all of the contracts that are at issue here, and all of the contracts are alleged to be illegal. So I think the assertion that we haven't identified contracts is not consistent with the record. I would also invite the court's attention to paragraph 43 of the complaint, which in addition to the various allegations we've discussed, we also specifically allege that this damaged us. And I think that meets our requirements under the rules to plead conduct and plead that it's damaged.
When you say this, are you referring back to the minority set-aside? Are you referring to the auction small business?
Paragraph 43 is the part of the illegality.
Did you say 43 or 33?
43.
Oh, okay.
That's the end of the illegality count. We allege all of the illegalities, including both that you've mentioned, and then say with regard to all of those illegalities, the government's violation of the law
that
would push the price down but damaged us. With regard to the record, again, we are on a motion to dismiss. I I would point to the appendix page 755, where the government stipulated is perhaps the wrong word, stated that they were not challenging the factual allegations in the complaint. So I sort of shifting positions a little bit like a whirligig here, in the sense that having below conceded all the factual allegations, I think now finding that that's problematic for them, and trying to come back and challenge the very allegations that they conceded. I'd also cite to the Shore versus Rhodes case in the Supreme Court, stating that it's well established on the motion to dismiss, including one for a lack of subject matter jurisdiction, that the allegations in the complaint should be favorably construed, if not put in evidence, controverted by evidence by the moving party. And there's no allegation here that they have put in, contested with evidence, our allegations that we were damaged by the government's violation of the law.
Thank you, and thanks to both counsel for working overtime and helping the court. The case is submitted.
Thank you.